We are past our hump day. It is in the rearview mirror, and man, is it busy getting set for week two in the NFL, coming down to the wire in the Major League Baseball regular season. And how about the final few games of the WNBA regular season? That includes a game between the Fever and the Aces at Gainbridge Fieldhouse. In fact, they will match up again in the Fever's next home game. Vegas Aces, the two-time defending champions, they got the win on Wednesday night. And how about this? We have a brand new single-season scoring record. It was set in that game. Meanwhile, Caitlin Clark is within a handful of assists of the single-season record for rookie or veteran. She needs just five more, if I counted correctly. So we have a lot to do, a lot that we want to get to as we head through these next few hours. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence on the Infinity Sports Network at A-Law Radio. Also on our Facebook page, I've got photos up from this Wednesday, September 11th, and the anniversary, 23 years since the worst terror attack on our nation's soil. We are pleased to welcome Steve Weisch, who is the chief national reporter for the NFL Network. And Steve, if you don't mind, I'd like to start there. Sports were part of the healing in our country post 9/11. A lot of people credit sports with bringing the spirit and the energy of our nation back. We see that happen so often, and I don't always understand it. So I'd like to pose the question to you. Why do you think that sports have the ability to bring us together and to heal?
All thoughts and memories out to the families and the people who are so affected by that. I remember it vividly. But I think sports is healing because, and this was told to me years ago, it's one of the few things in Americana where someone who is an eighth grade dropout can have a conversation with somebody with a PhD regarding, you know, the Eagles versus the Cowboys. There's no racial boundaries, so to speak, in terms of having a discussion or going to attend a game or coaching a little league team. You know, the things with gender and everything else that can upset people in normal political conversations or other types of conversations, they tend to go out the window when we're talking about sports. Because if you're a fan of the Minnesota Vikings, you know, you can talk about Justin Jefferson, you can talk about Sam Darnold, and sports have just a way of healing and crossing so many boundaries, humanizing everything. That's why people seek it as a respite so many times when things in everyday life are pretty tough.
It does tend to bring us together, as you point out, across all types of different boundaries that might generally divide us. And somehow, when we get into that arena or we have the ability to support our teams, it seems like all of those different boundaries just fly out the window. Not just after 9/11, when football was so instrumental, even after natural disasters and other tragedies where people are just so grateful to have that community.
1,000%. I mean, I was at the first game back in the Superdome when the Falcons played the Saints after Hurricane Katrina. You know, and you're saying to yourself, this is the venue where people had to flee to when their homes were destroyed. This is the venue where people actually died, where people lost loved ones. And then next thing you know, you've got this huge game. I think you two opened up pregame. And then Steve Gleason, who we all know now for the, you know, wave no flags, you know, who the Saints blocks the punt of Michael Kanan. The Saints score and go on to rout the Falcons. Just how that game, I've never felt energy like that in any sporting event, no matter a big fight I've covered, Super Bowls, of just unity. And like, man, did New Orleans as a city and the United States need that to get us over like such a tremendous disaster.
That spirit that you talk about, it's unlike anything else. Steve Weisch is with us from the NFL Network, chief national reporter, part of NFL Game Day Preview and the Insiders, and we're always so glad to have him here on the show. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Steve, what are a few elements, a few storylines that stand out to you after just this one week, this smaller sample size?
Well, I mean, first off, I mean, week one is always, I call it, the biggest non-truth teller, because some teams are going to look great. They're going to come back down to earth. Some teams are going to struggle. You know, I don't think the Cincinnati Bengals are going 0-17. Let's start there. I mean, the Bengals losing to the New England Patriots. I mean, everyone came into the season, the Patriots have no talent, this and that, and they go pull off an upset. You know, and that just goes to show, we talk about on any given Sunday how that could happen. Now, the Patriots might not win too many more games, but they've got that one in the books, and they already put the Bengals on their heels in the toughest division in football. I think the opener, that game with the Chiefs and the Ravens was amazing. You know, Lamar Jackson almost pulling out a one-man show after so many things broke down, but then there's Patrick Mahomes pulling out the magic and their defense showing that it can still be one of the more dominant teams. So there's just so many things. I mean, what about Dallas? You know, you have all the stuff, the contract gets done with Dak Prescott before the game. CeeDee Lamb hasn't been there for a week. And then those two go out against Cleveland, a great defense, and they play pitch and catch all afternoon. Just a couple of interesting things that are setting the table for week two, and I think also including, you know, the injury to Jordan Love in Green Bay, like, woo.
Right.
How deflating is that? You know, he might be out for several weeks. A team a lot of people said could challenge for the Super Bowl, still could, but just out of the gate, having to go to the backup quarterback, Malik Willis, in week two.
Starting off in this week two, we have the Thursday night game between the Bills and the Dolphins. A lot of history there, of course. Now you've got guys who are recently departed from Buffalo who are playing in Miami. The Bills, their roster has changed so much. Josh Allen, the consistent, plus that coaching staff too. But how heavy are the expectations for him, considering what's happened the last few years with the Bills?
They're significantly heavy. I mean, we know how great of a player he is. He's a deserved MVP. But he's coming into a season now where he's got new receivers. He's lost Stephon Diggs. He's lost Gabe Davis. You know, this seems like it's going to be more of a tight end-centric offense. And he may have to put up even more points because this defense is going to be a work in progress. The secondary changed. The defensive front gets Von Miller back. Is it going to be as good as it's been? They've already lost Matt Milano, their linebacker. So the expectations should still be there on him and also their head coach, Sean McDermott. I mean, losing coordinators over the last couple of years. He's kind of the last man standing from the big run they had a few years ago, other than Allen. There's going to be heavy expectations in what should be a great division, you know, with the Jets having Aaron Rodgers back, with the Dolphins, I can't wait for the game tomorrow, to me being the best team in the division, and the Patriots, Amy, being 1-0 out of the gate.
Right? It's crazy stuff. As for the Dolphins, we know that they really came together when Mike McDaniel took that head coaching job. What is it about him, his style, how he manages this team that brought them together in a way that they really hadn't been before that?
Yeah, I mean, I think he takes the approach that a lot of people that he's coached with, Sean McVay and Kyle Shanahan and guys like that, take is, I'm going to treat you like men unless you give me a reason not to. Right? And so he lets guys be individuals. He lets them be who they are, but he expects them to be total professionals and play to his style of coaching. And we know he's a great offensive schemer who puts players in positions to succeed. It's a cliche, but when you see, okay, I'm going to design a passing game that's going to work for Tua. I'm going to design a run game that's going to let Raheem Mostert lead the NFL in touchdowns. I mean, I think it's that. I think he probably does coach them tougher than what we've seen on Hard Knocks and things like that. But he also just treats them in a way that's like, okay, this guy's good. I really want to go out and play hard for him, but I also want to make sure I do everything that I can to make my teammates succeed.
Steve Wyche is with us from the NFL Network. Already looking ahead to week two. Man, we get so excited about the start of the season, and then boom, the weekend is gone. And in the rearview mirror, it's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. The Cleveland Browns coming off of that game against Dallas. Now this extra allegation against Deshaun Watson, which he denies. But if you're the Browns, at what point does this just give you a real bad sense of indigestion about the money that you spent on this guy?
They apparently have got some good antacids because they've just redone it. Even you know, they just redid his deal to give more cash up front to clear cap space. But, yeah, I mean, they've already put a ton of money in his pocket. And, yes, this latest allegation has got to be alarming and troublesome. But they knew this coming in, not necessarily this allegation, but they knew what they were dealing with when they signed him
right. And
guaranteed him $230 million. They may close their eyes and say, okay, we'll deal with all this off-the-field stuff as long as he's going to win. You know, this is the guy who's going to get – he's going to be our franchise quarterback. Well, he hasn't been that the past couple of years. And there's no player in the NFL that entered the season with more pressure on him, because it's not just the money – It's not just the off-field stuff, but when you look at what the Browns gave up to Houston to acquire Deshaun Watson, and you see how the Texans have used those assets to turn them into players like Will Anderson and Tank Dell, and now they're more of a favorite to get to the Super Bowl than Cleveland. All those things together is like, man, to me, that's why Deshaun Watson has just got so much pressure on him to come out and win, and in a lot of cases make people look the other way as to some of the other allegations and things that have happened.
Steve, if you're the Giants, and there are already calls in New York for them to bench Daniel Jones after just the one game, which is an overreaction, of course, but what do you do about Daniel Jones? How do you help him and the offense to succeed?
This is definitely something to watch in week two, because I think the Giants, especially as we saw in the Hard Knocks offseason, they have pushed in all their chips on him. This season is riding on him succeeding. Now, they've got a game against Washington this week where they're not playing as tough of a defense, right? They're playing a defense that gave up four touchdown passes. But you scheme things early to get him going. You make it simple for him, as simple as possible, to get his confidence going. Because the Giants keep losing. If they lose to Washington, those calls are going to get super loud already to replace him with Drew Lock. And if they lose the next week, soon that coaching staff is going to get desperate. It's either him or us who's going to be out of here.
Whew.
When that happens, we've seen it over and over, Amy. Okay, let's get his butt out of there. Let's get the next guy in. Mm. Okay, that comes with rolling the dice. But the losses, it's productivity, which these coaches are judged on. And if the losses pile up and he's not playing well, and they've invested so much of the success of the franchise in him, they'll have to make a move to try to save their own hides.
One more quarterback question, though. With Mike Tomlin and the Steelers, they've got two guys. Justin Fields looks like he's going to start again in week number two. How do they get more out of that offense?
Well, they have to get touchdowns, because if you watch that game, you did see some good things from Justin Fields, especially kind of the combination with him and George Pickens. It seems like they've got something going on there. So you work that, right? You understand that, yes, you want to run the ball with Najee Harris and Jaylen Warren and get Fields on some scheduled runs, but, you know, he made some throws that were very impressive outside the numbers. Now, is he always going to hit the obvious wide open man? No. That's just what you're going to get out of Justin Fields. He's had enough of a body of work for us to see that he's not the most consistent player. But having a coordinator like Arthur Smith, who likes a run-heavy offense, they've got to do things to maybe keep him on the move a little bit and to try to hit some of those downfield throws, because, you know, if they go into Denver and he plays a little bit better than he does against Atlanta, I don't think we're talking about Russell Wilson coming in and replacing him anymore. I think it's going to be Justin Fields' job to lose.
Steve Wyche is with us from the NFL Network, already looking ahead to week two, processing what we got in the first weekend. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Where do you see a couple teams that are flying under the radar and could be dark horses this season because of the moves they've made and because of where they started?
Well, I mean, the Seattle Seahawks lead that list for me. I think they had a pretty good foundation as it was with Geno Smith. Some good running backs on offense. We know they got three outstanding wide receivers in an improving offensive line. I think they're a team that they're going to be very solid defensively. That secondary with Devin Witherspoon and Reek Woolen. They've got some guys up front. I just think they're a very solid team. And with Mike McDonald coaching them with a really good staff, I think we really need to watch them. My other team, Amy, and I've been saying this, that people are not giving enough credit to, is the Minnesota Vikings. Now, we know they came out and they had the week one win. But that is a talented football team. Now, of course, you know, J.J. McCarthy, the rookie quarterback, gets hurt. They get rid of Kirk Cousins, and Sam Darnold has shown us he can look very, very good, and then he can look very flustered when he's out there playing. But I think Kevin O'Connell is a good enough coach to do things to really ease some of the things that have hampered Darnold and to highlight his strengths. I mean, when you've got Justin Jefferson and Jordan Addison, eventually you're going to have T.J. Hockenson back. They've got a very good offensive line. You got Aaron Jones. Like, they've got talent on both sides of the football and really good coaches. And Brian Flores is a hell of a defensive coordinator. So I think Seattle and Minnesota are two teams, especially in the NFC, we need to continue to track as teams that folks may not think are going to do much right now that end up, you know, making pushes for the playoffs.
And that North Division, I know it's just 1 week, but knowing what we know about those four teams, man, that could end up being a really tough battle this year.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's something that has dawned on me. I was talking about it in preseason. The average age of quarterbacks is getting younger and younger in the NFL. But it's not just that, Steve. It's also the coaches, the head coaches. They're getting younger and younger. What's your reaction to that, that kind of sliding scale toward youth in the NFL?
It's trendy. It is a trend. And look, you can't argue against it because guys have succeeded. You know, it started with Sean McVay, and then you see a Mike McDaniel, and you see some of these younger coaches getting opportunities. They've won. The Matt LaFleur, like, they've won. You know, part of it could be that coach a scheme a certain way, but there could be a relatability as well, a relatability that, you know, a lot of us, you know, saw back in the day teams didn't want. You want the authoritarian and the experienced coach who's paid his dues to tell you what to do. Well, now you have these young, really sharp guys who can relate to you, and they seek your input to help them put you in better place. Like, I don't know all the answers. I haven't lived enough life to know all the answers. So why don't you help me? And then let's, as a combination, figure things out to make everybody better. So I don't think that's a one size fits all statement, but I think that absolutely has played into it in certain situations.
How different it must feel in the Patriots locker room for the guys who played under Bill Belichick and now Gerard Mayo. And he definitely has talked about the collaboration and wanting to hear from guys. And once again, he's in his late 30s, right? A completely different atmosphere there.
And a guy who was brought up playing for and coaching under Bill Belichick.
Yes.
Who was using a different approach, because look at how many people we've seen, at least coaching disciples, who've gone elsewhere, who tried to be him, who've tried to implement things the way he did, and it didn't work. I mean, overwhelmingly across the board, when people have tried that it didn't work. Whereas, you know, Mayo has seen, okay, let me take the things that have worked. Let me take the observations that haven't. Let me be my own man, and let's see if my style as a relatable young guy can work with these players while also using some of the strong teaching principles and expectations that Bill Belichick made his calling card. Let's incorporate those in a way that makes people feel valued, but at the same time, understand the accountability that it takes to win ball games.
Speaking of Belichick, Steve, when did he turn into such a chatty Cathy? He's everywhere.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, think about all the people, like I think about Sterling Sharp, who didn't talk to the media, who became a really good media guy, a very good speaker. Marshawn Lynch, right, who didn't speak to the media. He's just like the darling, right? And now there's Bill Belichick, who, when you talk to people, you know, I used to work with Willie McGinnis, one of my favorite people I've ever worked with. And he said, look, Belichick is not what you see when he's mumbling at these press conferences. Like, when he's with the team, he's great. Like, guys really think highly of him. He's funny. He's this and that. He comes up with creative ways to keep guys engaged. And maybe we're starting to see some of that more as he tries to, you know, rebrand himself in a way. You know, we heard him say he wants to coach again, as to where he's attractive to some of these owners who might not know him.
You know, it's funny, though. I thought about the Bill Cowher situation where he said the same thing. We all thought he would get back into coaching. And then he really got to the point where he enjoyed the schedule of broadcasting and not having to have carry so much stress, and just eventually never got back into it. What if we never see Bill Belichick on the sidelines again?
I don't think initially it would be his choice. Look, a lot of coaches just got passed over. And we just talked about it, Amy. Like, there's a trend of the young guys. And I think that hurt Bill Belichick this cycle, right, where he really only interviewed with one team, and that being the Atlanta Falcons, because everybody wanted a young, hot offensive coordinator. You know, Belichick might say, hey, the schedule's great, this lifestyle's great, but, man, when you coach, especially when you're that close to being the all-time winningest head coach, and nobody comes knocking at your door, that has to hurt a little bit, too. So I think that might be why we're kind of seeing him recast himself a little bit in the public eye.
Okay, so then looking at the other end of the spectrum, why are Andy Reid and John Harbaugh so successful in relating to their locker rooms and getting the best out of their guys?
It's definitely not about age. And, you know, one thing, if you ever met Andy Reid, he is a very warm, a very jovial guy, who really, you know, when you, when I, the, you know, the 20 years or so I've been doing this, he's the one I've heard more so people say he will treat you like a man until you give him reason not to. And then he will get rid of you. You know, and I think part of his thing as well is while he always keeps the nucleus of his teams together, he changes his players enough to keep things fresh, to keep him fresh. And then when you get a talented quarterback like Patrick Mahomes, that works. And then John Harbaugh, who's an Andy Reid disciple, who's been doing it for a long time, you know, they lose coaches all the time. And his coaching tree seems to get plucked over and over.
Yeah.
So I think he's constantly challenged to bring in people who fit the mold of that building, which I think is probably the best run organization in the NFL, while also coming up with brilliant thinkers who relate to players in a certain way. It is a hard thing to do. We've seen teams get hit with a coaching drain. We saw the Rams go through it a couple of years ago when their coaches kept getting picked off and they took a couple steps back, because it's just hard to constantly replenish and coach your coaches and how to behave on, and how to, you know, to adapt to the building lifestyle and also adapt to your coaching lifestyle. And he's found a method that works. And so it isn't about age. A lot of it is just about being flexible, being reliable, and not thinking that you know everything and seeking the input of others to help you.
Steve, before I let you go, we have a bunch of teams that will have their home openers this weekend. Green Bay comes to mind. Dallas is another one. Obviously, a bunch of these teams. Baltimore. What's one of your favorite atmospheres in the NFL in terms of the electricity and the fans?
I mean, there's no place like Lambeau. I mean, that the Lambeau Field is the bucket list just because the town is so special. The people are so special. I mean, my favorite place in the world is New Orleans in terms of football environment, just because the people – The connective tissue of that city and its people. I mean, for years they were just a laughing stock, and then the fans still loved them. And then they started winning, and the way they share and the joy and everything. There's just so many great places, though. I mean, you know, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, the way those fans, you know, really, really adapt to their team. You know, like I said, it's a connective tissue between team and city. But again, so my favorite is probably New Orleans, just because I love the people down there. I love the city, and I love the way they support that club.
And that's perfect, because New Orleans is hosting the Super Bowl again in 25, which is, gosh, a few short months from where we are right now, because we're off and running. Yeah, Steve Wyche is NFL Network's chief national reporter. It's always great for us to be able to get you here on the show at Wyche89. And you can catch him on the Insiders Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, 7 o'clock Eastern on NFL Network. But gosh, you see him other places too. You're a busy guy, Steve. So thank you so much for making time for us.
Always great, Amy.
Lots of fun stuff there with Steve, always. At least I'm not the only one who's surprised by Bill Belichick turning into a chatty Cathy. And I am starting to worry a little bit that he might not ever get back on the sidelines. But really great intel on the quarterbacks as well as coaches and the youth trend, the youth movement in the NFL. If you missed any of our conversations, our interviews here on the show, they're always podcasted separately. We post that link every weekday morning on both our Twix and our Facebook page. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence.
One. Jazz grounds it. Diving stop went. Throw to the plate. Not in time. It's wide. Birdie scores. Jazz Chisholm wins the game. And the Yankees walk off the Royals 4-3-11.
This is After Hours with Amy Lawrence.
Manuel Babari on the Yankees Radio Network. Jazz Chisholm with the walk-off single, as the Yankees rally past the Royals, and definitely needed that spirit, definitely needed that spark, if you will, maybe that springboard, as the Yankees are in a battle against the Baltimore Orioles atop the American League East, but also as the Royals, and then before that, the Rangers have had some pretty impressive wins against them. And so the Royals have hit 80 wins, and this one is determined in a walk-off. And not just that, but extra innings. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Right now, the Yankees Orioles remain status quo. They remain static. Would that be the word? They remain stagnant. No, it's not stagnant. Static, though, as in there was no movement. A game and a half up because, wait, I thought the Orioles won on Wednesday. Did I get that wrong? Let me go back and look because according to this particular set of standings, oh, yeah, they lost in extra innings themselves.
Yes.
Are you ready? All right. We can bring it to you. I should have remembered this.
Keegan Aiken is ready. Here's his pitch. And he swings and drives one to left. High and deep. And this ball is long gone. A walk-off home run. Tyler O'Neill. And the Red Sox have won it. Their first walk-off home run of the year. The final 5-3 Red Sox. O'Neill hits number 30.
Man, it's awesome. Playing in Boston in September, meaningful baseball. This is, you know, it's a dream come true. It was a great game out there. Boys scrapped all day, so it was awesome to get that win at the end.
All right, so that is Tyler O'Neill on Nesson. Of course, talking about the playoff atmosphere there because the Red Sox are hoping for a wild card. They beat the Orioles in extras. All right. Then after that, you get Yankees and Royals and the walk-off for New York. So I take it all back. No one was static. No one was stagnant. There was actually some movement. Don't listen to me. Wait, actually, that's a bad idea. I need you to listen to me, but I will admit when I get it wrong, when I get the details convoluted and mixed up, you know, my spaghetti plate brain. So, yes, the Yankees win, the Orioles lose, which means it's now a game and a half separation between the two atop the American League East. As for the Red Sox, they are barely above 500 and right now 4 games out of that third wild card spot. So Orioles, of course, would have the top spot if the playoffs were to begin today. Royals are sitting right behind them. And then the Twins are in that third spot, which is pretty amazing. How about the AL Central representing? It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Let's see. So the Yankees Orioles is a really tight race. We haven't seen the Royals and Twins climb back into it in the Central the way that they did. Remember when the Royals briefly held the lead over the Guardians in the Central? They were on some kind of crazy surge to the point where we even did an interview about the Royals, which was fun. So Twins and Royals have fallen back a bit, but as we just talked about, they would hold the second and third wild cards at this point. Astros, they've dropped 3 in a row. They lost Altuve to an injury. We don't know how serious it is on Wednesday. I don't know that you should ever count them out. However, it seems more unlikely than ever that they will be able to extend their streak of appearances in the ALCS. Right now, it's 7 consecutive seasons, which is cray. Yeah, they've had all kinds of issues. Guys in and out of their pitching rotation, guys in and out of their lineup. They've really scuffled in large stretches. So they've been highly inconsistent. The Mariners, after firing their manager, are at least above 500 again. So I guess it's not a foregone conclusion that the Astros will win the AL West. And then we talked about the teams in the National League where the tightest race is Dodgers and Diamondbacks. And right now that's a 5-game cushion. 855-212-4227. That's our toll-free line. Now that we got all of that cleared up, we had a battle at the Gainbridge Fieldhouse between the Fever and the Aces. The Fever want to get to where the Aces are, but it was a milestone night for Asia Wilson, who was the most recent WNBA Finals MVP, that in 2023. And yeah, some great history on the line, too, before the end of the season for Caitlin Clark. So we'll get to that. My mom sent me a text. The Fever lost. Caitlin didn't shoot well with a sad face. She is so into it. They now have a little stuffed replica of the Fever mascot. And she has a mug. So her husband bought her a mug and a stuffed mascot to go along with her Caitlin Clark jersey. Okay. I mean, they are the example of how Caitlin Clark is bringing people to the game that never watched this sport before.
Embrace it for sure.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. Glad to hear that you all liked the conversation with Steve Wyche. Thank you for your notes at A-Law Radio, also on our Facebook page. Good to connect with you on this Wednesday night. We are cruising downhill toward another football weekend. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Here's our latest sports update, and here's Pete McCarthy.
Infinity Sports Network, Sports Flash.
Well, Amy, Shohei Ohtani's about to open up the 50-50 club. Ohtani with one of four Dodgers home runs in the first inning. He also stole a base to reach 47 homers and 48 stolen bags on the year. The Dodgers beat the Cubs by a final score of 10-8. Tyler O'Neill providing a big moment in Boston.
Keegan Aiken is ready. Here's his pitch. And he swings and drives one to left. High and deep. And this ball is long gone. A walk-off home run. Tyler O'Neill. And the Red Sox have won it. Their first walk-off home run of the year. The final 5-3 Red Sox. O'Neill hits number 30.
Joe Castiglione, Red Sox Radio. Sox beat the Orioles, and the Yankees walked off the Royals in 11, so New York now owns a game-and-a-half lead in the AL East. The Mets were being no-hit for 8 innings. They not only broke it up in the ninth, they rallied to score 6 runs, beating the Blue Jays 6-2. Braves lose to the Nationals 5-1. They also lose pitcher Reynaldo Lopez to the injured list. The Mets now a game ahead of the Braves in the NL wildcard race. Deshaun Watson denied allegations of sexual assault and battery that were filed in a civil lawsuit this week. He did so through his lawyer, Rusty Hardin, who said in part that they are comfortable that Watson will ultimately be vindicated. Watson is not concerning himself that he could face another suspension.
You know, that's something that, you know, the NFL has to, you know, do on their time, and, you know, I have to focus on what's in front of me right now.
The NFL is reviewing. In the meantime, Watson will start against the Jaguars on Sunday. Bengals quarterback Joe Burrow was seen flexing his wrist on the sideline Sunday. He says no issues.
Feels great. Feels better this week than it did last week, than it did the week before, so it's continually getting better.
The Bengals face the Chiefs. WNBA Asia Wilson breaks the league's single-season scoring record. Wilson and the Aces topping Caitlin Clark in the Fever 86-75. Clark shot just 1 of 10 from 3. I'm Pete McCarthy.
This is the Infinity Sports Network. Follow us on Instagram. Our handle is Infinity Sports Network. That's Infinity Sports Network to follow us on Instagram.
Depending upon where you are, it's a different time of the night. What I love about the freedom of this radio show is, honestly, we can give a little something for everyone, whatever you happen to be doing at the time, whether working, trying to sleep, sleeping, insomnia, driving, procrastinating, going to the gym, walking your dog, trying to wake up. What'd you say?
More insomnia.
Yeah, there's always that issue. I come from a mom who has major sleep issues. I've always had them. And I know part of it is because I sleep during the daytime. And just it's naturally our body clocks are, yeah, they're not, our circadian rhythms, our body clocks, they're not made to sleep during the daytime. You can make your room as dark as the bottom of a cave, and still your body knows when it's daylight outside. And so I have a hard time, but my room is not particularly dark. And so even when I am able to sleep for 4 hours or so at a time, that's a pretty good day. And then I end up waking up and tossing and turning. So I don't sleep great. My husband doesn't either, poor guy, and he has the luxury of sleeping at night. I'm pretty jealous. Every time I have to leave at night and walk out of the house, I'm thinking, I just want to stay here.
Sleeping at night, wow, what a concept.
Oh, stop it. You've been on this shift for all of a week and a half, though you did used to wake up at 3:30 a.m. Eastern time.
That's right, been early.
I know, because producer Jay would have to send you a text if he didn't hear from you.
I just...
As if it was Jay's responsibility to get you out of bed.
It's my responsibility. sleep, but I was just being considerate to Jay, where I don't oversleep, and he has to be here.
Oh, whoa, is that how it works?
Yeah.
What happens when you accidentally oversleep from napping? Is there someone to wake you up? Is your wife going to know when you're drop dead hour of awakening?
Yeah, there's a
needs to be.
There's a time. I tell her every day. Every day, there's a time. If you don't see me, make sure I'm up.
Now, when you were waking up at the crazy hour, I'd rather be up all night than have to get up at 3:30 in the morning. Would she wake up as well?
No.
That's nice, because I have that fear. I do sometimes, not always, obviously, not on nights we have football, and it's rare, but there are times when I try to lay down when my husband goes to bed, and I'll listen to a game, or I will, on the rare occasion, be able to just take a nap. And I feel so badly. First of all, I move around a bunch, but second of all, my side of the bed creaks. It's an older bed, so we've tried to fix it, but it still creaks. And then lastly, I just feel terrible about waking him up. So I'm always trying to be really, really quiet, but I'm not always successful. In fact, since he just got home from Texas on Monday night, he had still been in the process of unpacking on Tuesday night. So I'm in the dark bedroom trying to get my stuff together. Usually I put it out in the other room, but I was trying to get something else out of the room, and I kicked his suitcase, black suitcase, in the dark with my bare foot, and ow! and then the cat comes into the bedroom and starts howling. Huh. So yeah, it's like a zoo there half the time. The cat is obviously nocturnal, and as most cats are, and she, the second I come out of the room, if I happen to be in there, starts howling and talking to me, and just follows me downstairs howling. And so, yeah, it's either me going, shh, sugar, shh, or it's the cat howling, or it's me kicking something, or sometimes me, I don't know, walking down the stairs and hitting every single creaky board in the stairs. The house is old. It was built in 1951. And so there's just a lot of creaks and squeaks. One of our closet doors where I get my coat, it is the loudest creaky door. Oh my gosh. And I'm always astounded, because I'm a really light sleeper, that he can sleep through any of that.
Yeah, light. I will say light is my Achilles heel. Mm. Sometimes when I turn on the light, that's when my wife will wake up and say, turn off the light. Or even not wake up and just say, turn off the light while she's sleeping. So yeah, I can make noise too, but the light, if I turn on a light, any type of light, it could be in a part of the house that she's nowhere near, she's going to say, turn off the light.
Really?
Yep.
Even if you're in a completely different room?
Yeah, it's just how she likes darkness when she sleeps. Mm.
Well, I do too. Thankfully, I actually sleep with something over my ear and like my eye. So if I'm laying on my side, just because that helps me to block out what else is out there. Otherwise, like I said, I'm a light sleeper and I can hear everything that's going on downstairs. I was actually really pleased because the last few nights in our neighborhood, it's been in the 50s. And so we've had the windows open as opposed to the AC on. But then about midday, when my husband goes to the gym, he will turn on the AC because it starts to get warm in the house. And so the last couple days, he's come up during my sleeping hours to check and make sure I have the windows closed in the bedroom, and I didn't hear him. That's a big deal. That means I'm sleeping really well.
That's an accomplishment.
Yes. All right. We mentioned Asia Wilson, the Las Vegas Aces. Asia was in pursuit of the single season WNBA scoring record. She now owns it. 27 points against the Fever on Wednesday night. She's at 956 now. Would you believe no one in WNBA history has ever had a season with more than 1,000 points? But she's pretty close.
My teammates are the ones, they're the heartbeat. They get me going. I don't get 0 points, obviously, without them passing me the basketball. But just the way they show up to work every single day, just ready to play, ready to lock in. Things we go through in our personal lives, we lock in each other every single day. And that's what you see on the court. So the points are great. They're going to always be there. I'm never going to stop shooting. But the group that we have in this locker room is something that I'm so genuinely happy to be around. So I'm blessed. I'm super blessed to be able to do what I do with the people that I do. And I credit it all to them.
definitely emotional, Asia Wilson, in setting the WNBA's new single season scoring record. It happened toward the end of the first half on Wednesday night. She's a two-time MVP, potentially going to be a three-time MVP. I don't know that that's much in doubt. There isn't anyone playing as well as she is right now. She was also the finals MVP from last fall. And yeah, as a real shot, I would say it's probably a given as long as she's healthy, though she did recently miss a game with an ankle injury. She's pretty close to being the first ever to go over 1,000 points in a season. Now, as for Caitlin Clark, she needed 11 assists to set the new single season record. This was a game in which the Aces were up most of the time by double figures. Clark finishes with a really poor shooting night. 1 of 10 from 3, 6 of 22 overall. Only 6 assists, so she needs 5 more to set the new single season mark for assists. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence.